There's the blue light. Good morning. It is April the 30th. That means tomorrow is May 1st. And we are here at the Education Sub of Ways and Means with Megan and the Early Childhood. I'd like to reopen our hearing on House Bill 5016, dealing with early childhood programs. And Megan, welcome back.
Thank you. Good morning. Co-chairs Monroe and Comp, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Megan Irwin, acting early learning system director at the Department of Education.
My hearing is a little better today.
Oh, good.
But you'll still need to speak up if you want me to pay attention to what you're saying. I have pretty severe ear infection in the left ear. The right ear was all blocked. We got that cleaned out. My wife got me some peroxide. And she's been dumping peroxide into my ears, and that has helped some. So hopefully by Monday I'll be good as new. Madam Co-Chair.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, can I ask Megan a question before we get started?
Sure.
Okay. Megan, I have a number of constituents that use the 211, mm-hmm. and I heard that you knew something about what's happening with 211. Is that a fallacy, or?
Co-chairs Comp and Monroe, members of the committee, I that's a broad question. I'm not sure how to answer what's happening with 211.
Okay. Well, somebody said you knew everything about it, so.
I wish. I think it's a great service. A lot of families use it to find services, but that's about what I know about 211.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, sorry.
Well, I appreciate your open, honest candor on it.
Mr. Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the subcommittee. If you don't mind, Megan, I just want to set the stage a little bit, because this really wasn't a large part of the presentation, but the child care portion and what she will probably talk about most today is around the staffing and some of the funding mechanisms for both the Child Care Development Fund, which is a block grant from the feds, as well as their Race to the Top. The importance of this is it's a major funding source for her division, the Early Learning Child Division, both in terms of funding and for administrative funding. The Race to the Top grant is slowly going away. Next, it runs through most of this coming biennium, but not quite the last 6 months. Okay. It's gone. And that has some significant consequences for funding of her staff, and there's things in the governor's recommended budget to take care of that. And finally, we have to remember that the Child Care Development Fund is a major funding source for ERDC over in DHS. And so whatever happens in terms of the Early Learning Division of using that fund for programs, staffing, and other initiatives does affect ERDC also. So those are sort of important issues, both short-term and long-term, and I thought it was important to make sure the subcommittee knew that as they take action later on the budget.
Thank you.
Thanks, Doug. So that's right. Today's presentation is on child care, and it's really focusing on the federal funding streams for child care so that you can have that in your minds as you're building the budget and setting our division's spending limitation. Before I get started, there was a question yesterday about preschool teacher salaries.
Oh.
Our staff did some research on that, submitted it to Doug, and you have it in OLIS, and you also have it in front of you so you can see the average preschool teacher salaries in our state by education level. At the highest level, that's a classroom teacher with an advanced degree. It's about $25,000 a year. The lowest level, a classroom teacher with no credential, is at about $15,000 per year, and there's a range in there. So just wanted to make sure we provided you that information as follow-up. And Senator Roblin, we are also working on those graphs, and we'll get those over to you. The program staff is over in Bend at a Head Start convening, and so we'll have to get that for you next week.
No problem.
Great. Okay, so like Doug just framed up for you, today we're going to be talking about child care. And as I discussed in my first round of conversation with this committee, this is a really big part of our work. Almost two-thirds of our staff is in the Office of Child Care. We annually perform on-site monitoring visit of 4,300 childcare facilities, and this work directly impacts 68,000 children under the age of 5 who are in licensed childcare programs. And so at the division, we have an obligation to parents to ensure the health and safety of these settings. And we also know that what happens in childcare, where a significant portion of our children are, is critically important if we ever want to reach our school readiness goals. And so there's both a regulatory function to this work and a program quality function to this work. Almost all of the funding for the work that we do is federal. Oregon was awarded a $30 million Early Learning Challenge Race to the Top grant, and that's really helped us move forward as a key investment in our infrastructure and is what allowed us to bring a child care quality rating and improvement system to the state, and I'll talk more about that later. But even more important than Race to the Top is the funding that we receive through the Child Care Development Fund, which you'll hear me call CCDF through the course of this presentation. That's about $133 million in funding per biennium, which means that anytime there's a change in rules about how that funding can be used, it has a big impact on our work. And the most significant changes in CCDF rules in over 15 years are on their way. These changes are going to impact how we allocate CCDF dollars, and that impact is going to be felt strongest in the 2017-19 biennium, but we'll start to feel the impact this biennium, and I'm going to go over that in some detail because this committee needs to understand what that looks like. Just a little bit of framing up around why childcare matters. This is really the foundation for everything I'm going to talk about today and the foundation for what we believe when it comes to childcare. This work is a two-generation investment. It's an investment in families who need childcare so that they can work, and it's an investment in kids who need quality settings that promote positive child development and learning.
And Megan, you can't do one of those things without doing them both.
That's exactly right.
I mean, it's so critical to involve families, parents, if we're really going to develop children that are ready for kindergarten at age 5.
That's exactly right. That Co-Chairs Comp and Monroe, Senator Monroe, thank you for saying that. That we share that belief, and it's foundational to all of the work that we do. The Early Learning Division partners with the Department of Human Services to make sure that childcare is both meeting the needs of working families and also promoting positive child development. This slide just shows you where kids are in childcare around our state and how many are in formal settings, informal settings, and at home with their parents. So like I said, the Early Learning Division partners with the Department of Human Services, and so the Early Learning Division is the lead agency for the Child Care Development Fund. We're the recipient of the funds. And then we transfer over 3/4 of those dollars to DHS to run employment-related daycare. And employment-related daycare provides subsidies to about 8,000 low-income working families to help offset the cost of childcare. Families choose the provider themselves, and the provider that they choose can be either a licensed childcare program or a license-exempt provider, like a neighbor who's taking care of only one or two kids. And they can also choose a relative, like grandma. The family that's on ERDC is still required to make a copay to the provider, and the amount of that copay depends on things like the family's income. The Department of Human Services is responsible for determining the eligibility of families and for processing those payments to providers. And the Early Learning Division is responsible for licensing and monitoring childcare, developing and providing a professional development system for the workforce, and strengthening early learning experiences by investing in the quality of childcare.
And I think we tend to feel that those informal situations are inferior, and sometimes they are, but sometimes they're not. You know, my wife, who is an elementary teacher and who was a day school director, raised our grandson every day and helped with his raising, and you know, it was like one-on-one tutorial almost. So there are situations where that informal person is very well qualified and doing an excellent job. There are a lot of other situations where it's not the case.
That's right. So in terms of the role of the Office of Child Care, in many ways we think of ourselves almost in our regulatory work as a consumer protection agency for parents who are choosing licensed child care. And our job is to make sure that parents who choose licensed child care know that they're making choices where the facility or the home that they're putting their child in has met some basic health and safety standards. And so that means our office conducts fingerprinting and criminal background checks on adults who might have contact with children. That's not just the staff of the child care facilities, it's also other adults, including family members who live in a licensed child care home. And last year we conducted 26,000 criminal background checks. We also do annual on-site inspections of child care programs to make sure that they're in compliance with our licensing regulations. That includes things like making sure the adult-to-child ratios are being met, that there's a proper amount of space for the number of children, that diapering practices are sanitary, that food is being handled properly, that staff are receiving the required hours of training. And that's just a partial list of the regulations that we're required to do monitoring on.
What proportion of child care facilities are currently licensed?
Co-chairs, Comp and Monroe, members of the committee, I'll have to get back to you on an answer to that because it's a little bit complicated to figure out. We have 4,300 licensed child care facilities, and then we have about 3,000 license-exempt providers who receive child care subsidy. And that's the universe that we know of. We don't know all of the license-exempt providers who are out there unless they're receiving a subsidy. So it's a little bit tricky to figure out how many people are not licensed and caring for children, because if they're not receiving a child care subsidy, they're not interacting with the state in any way, and we don't have a way of monitoring that. So we might be able to get you a rough estimate of that number, but those are the factors that would go into trying to figure it out.
And one of the concerns I have is that the background checks are being done, and they're only being done if they're licensed, right, not by these informal child care facilities. And so that can be a problem.
You're going to really like what I have to tell you about the new federal rules then. Preview, we're going to start to do background checks on a license-exempt care. Our office is also responsible for responding to and assessing complaints. So when anybody calls us and reports that they saw something in a licensed child care facility that didn't sit right with them, it's our job to investigate it, determine whether the complaint was justified, determine whether we can verify that it was justified, and determine whether corrective action is needed. And we assessed 702 complaints last year. And then we also have a responsibility to provide information to parents. When a facility is found to have compliance issues, we need to make sure that parents can find that information out, and that is posted on our website. So like I just said, there are 4,300 licensed child care facilities in Oregon. Many of these are run out of homes. Some of these are centers, but you can see registered family child care homes make up the largest proportion of licensed child care in our state. So this just gives you a quick overview of what that looks like.
Yes, Representative Taylor.
Thank you, Senator Monroe. So in public schools, such as Portland Public Schools, where they have the before and after child care provided, what category do they fall into?
Center-based care. Co-chairs Comp and Monroe, Representative Taylor, that's center-based care.
Okay, follow-up?
Go ahead.
Thank you. So with those facility, the schools that have those, I don't know how many schools have them, but I know that that's, I think, is growing because more people want to have before and after care. Are there efforts happening now between the Department of Education and the programs that exist already in the schools to be doing some of the literacy programs that we value so much and trying to make it so that they're a little more structured instead of just child care? Do you see what I'm saying?
Yes. Co-chairs Comp and Monroe, Representative Taylor, yes. And I think there's a wonderful advocacy group that works with after-school care providers and school-age child care providers focusing on exactly that. And then even in licensed childcare for younger kids, through the quality rating improvement system that I'll talk about later, we're really trying to focus on creating enriching educational experiences for kids when they're in childcare, so that readiness for school becomes a goal.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah.
Senator Roblin.
So on the graph that we had, the pie graph, that graph divides it by the certificates, but not by the kids. So do we know how many kids in a pie graph are in each of those different subgroups?
Co-chairs Comp and Monroe, Representative Roblin, we do, and I'll get you those numbers.
Okay. Because yeah. I would expect it's a little different than that.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
What we know is the capacity
right.
each.
That's what I'm, yeah, and that's what I would like to know.
Counts, but we know each, we know the basic
total
capacity.
Numbers.
Yeah.
Okay, that'd be great.
Yep, we'll get you those numbers as a follow-up. So it's also important to remember, and this is the point that Senator Monroe was just making, I think, is that there are an abundant number of children in childcare that's license exempt. And so license exempt care is where it's legal to receive money for taking care of children without being licensed by the state. And these are the kinds of license exempt care that exist in our state. The most significant group of license-exempt providers in our state are family child care providers who are taking care of three or fewer children. And you've probably heard these folks referred to as family, friends, and neighbor care. That's the term that gets used the most. A large portion of the children who are on employment-related daycare are served by this group of license-exempt providers, and that's important in the context of the federal rules that are changing that I'm going to talk to you about in a second. First, we wanted to do just some basics on what the Child Care Development Fund is before we talk about how it's changing. So we're going to move on to the Child Care Development Fund, the new rules, and what it means for our work. So this slide is just a reminder for you around how much of our investment in child care comes from the federal government. And as you can see from this chart, federal investment makes up 80% of the Office of Child Care's budget. So the Child Care Development Fund, which has been in its current form since 1996, really has two goals. Number one, financial assistance to low-income families so that they can access child care, so that they can work, attend job training, or attend school. And then number two, to provide funding to improve the quality of child care and increase the supply and availability of child care for families, including those who receive no direct assistance through CCDF. So our quality improvement efforts in child care benefit families who are on subsidy, and they also benefit any families who are sending their kid to a child care that we're working on quality improvement activities with. And during the 13-15 biennium, the Early Learning Division received $132 million in CCDF funding. And the lion's share of that, is about 81%, we transferred to the Department of Human Services for employment-related daycare. And the remaining funds are used to support the licensing and monitoring of child care facilities, our quality supports, and professional development for the workforce. The Child Care Development Fund, and this graph gets a little bit confusing, and I'll do my best to make it clear, but the Child Care Development Fund is really a combination of a couple of different federal funds that include federal mandatory dollars that are not subject to the annual congressional appropriations process, discretionary funds that are subject to congressional appropriations process, and then matching funds. All of the matching dollars and virtually all of the mandatory dollars are contracted to DHS by our office for ERDC, and then supports for licensing, monitoring, quality improvements, and professional development come out of the discretionary dollars. What's most important to take away from this slide is that there are maintenance of effort funds and matching amounts that we need to meet each year in order to draw down our full share of federal dollars. And that's $11.7 million in maintenance of effort and $11.9 million in match. So in addition to our federal fund investment, which is $13 million, which we count toward our maintenance of effort, we also include the refundable portion of the working family child care tax credit as part of our match. And then one thing that you'll notice on this slide is that there is a general fund contribution to our child care subsidy system of about $13 million. That's modest compared to the federal investment, And the governor's requested budget includes a major expansion of that investment by $49 million, which would raise the total general fund investment in child care subsidies to $62 million. And the discussion of that investment is not part of the $60 million that this committee is considering, Representative Huffman. And we'll go
Mr. Chair.
Through human services. Yep.
Representative Huffman.
Speaking of that $60 million, which now may be zero as of 8 o'clock this morning, we've got the governor's recommended budget. We've got the co-chair's framework. Are we now going to have the post-Supreme Court decision budget that we're going to review?
Mr. Co-chair.
Madam Co-chair.
I think Representative Huffman might be a little off topic, and can we continue?
Please.
Okay.
Sorry, Megan.
No problem. Good question. Anyway, it's easy to get lost in this slide, but the takeaway here really is we currently fund subsidies, matching funds with $13 million, and the governor's requested budget would bump that up significantly in terms of state investment in child care subsidies for low-income working families. So, as I previewed for you, just last fall, Congress passed the reauthorization of the Child Care Development Fund, and it was a big deal. It represented some of the most significant changes to the rules that govern this fund in 15 years. So, the reauthorization reaffirmed and strengthened CCDF's commitment to promoting positive child development and school readiness called out explicitly, which really validates a lot of the work that we're doing here in Oregon. And it also created some new requirements for health and safety monitoring, for fingerprinting and background checks, for training, for public reporting of licensing information. And many of these changes go into effect later in the next biennium, but they're significant enough that we have to start planning for them now. And so you'll see there will be some budgetary impact in this biennium. The major budgetary impact is going to be much greater in 17-19. And I just want this committee to be thinking about it now with us as we're doing our implementation planning. So the biggest of the policy changes in the rules is the new requirement for on-site health and safety monitoring for all providers receiving employment-related daycare subsidies, including license-exempt providers who are taking care of children on ERDC. Licensed care providers already receive annual monitoring, so we're covered in terms of the new rule in that area. But this is a brand new requirement for license-exempt providers. There are about 3,000 license-exempt providers taking care of children on ERDC at any one given time in our state. But the annual turnover in that workforce is around 1,600. So that's between 3,000 and 4,600 on-site monitoring visits that we've never conducted before that we're going to have to take on. And so we estimate a caseload of about one monitor for every 300 cases for this work, which is more than 2.5 times the caseload of our current licensing staff. Oregon now only requires fingerprints in really limited circumstances, primarily when individuals self-disclose that they've recently lived out of state or committed an out-of-state crime. The new rules will require more providers and others with access to children to pass background checks that include fingerprinting, and will also be required to provide more extensive and expensive background checks. The Early Learning Division conducts our background checks through something called the Law Enforcement Data System, LEDS, through the Oregon State Police on all individuals in licensed care. And that query includes the sex offender registry, a CPS services database check is also conducted on individuals. And annually, right now, we run approximately 28,000 background checks and then do a quarterly LEDS scan on all 63,000 individuals who are in the database. And so out of that universe, approximately 10% of those folks are also people who we've conducted FBI background checks on, that includes the fingerprinting. Under the new CCDF requirements, all background checks would include the FBI fingerprint check. So we're going from only doing fingerprinting on about 10% of that universe to doing fingerprinting on all. It's a big jump. Currently, a typical background check at our office that doesn't have any issues associated with it takes us 3 minutes to run. The new FBI fingerprint requirement is going to increase the time that it takes to do these, and we'll also add other additional costs. So there's the just raw cost of running these background checks and fingerprints on more people, and then the time cost to my staff in terms of getting it completed in a timely way. Finally, under the new rules, there are new pre-service and ongoing training requirements for childcare providers. And we currently have training requirements built into our licensing system. So again, there'll be few additional requirements for our licensed providers. These rules really, in all cases, have the biggest impact on license-exempt providers who receive subsidy. Just like the new monitoring requirements, the training requirements hit us the hardest when it comes to our work with license-exempt providers. Currently, they're required to take two-hour pre-service online health and safety training. Now, we'll also do additional pre-service training that will include first aid, CPR, child abuse prevention, additional health and safety training, and emergency and disaster preparation. Currently, there are no ongoing training requirements for license-exempt providers, and the new regulations will change that. But we're still waiting, along with every other state, a little bit more clarification from the federal government around what the expectation really is for ongoing training for these providers. It's not clear, and they're working on clarifying that for states. So we're not 100% sure what that impact is going to look like for us.
And does that training include the requirements that anybody working with children has to turn over to law enforcement any bruises, anything that they suspect might be abuse?
Co-chairs Comp and Monroe, yes it does. Members of the committee, yes it does. Yep. So this is the combined impact of the new rules in terms of dollars. And you can see it's not so bad in this upcoming biennium, and that's just because of the implementation timeline for the monitoring and background checks, for example, isn't until December 2016. So it really starts to hit us as we start to ramp up and do some planning, and then we'll be doing it in the back half of the biennium. The bigger impact is in 2017-18. And I just want everybody to see that now as we're thinking about the impact of these rule changes. This is what we anticipate the impact of these costs looking like in the next biennium in terms of how we might need to slice the CCDF pie. This slide looks at the impact if it was this slide looks at the impact of the changes to CCDF if we take some of the funding that we'll need to implement the new rules out of our quality childcare investments, which is a hard decision to make when we know that investing in quality and improving the quality of childcare is essential to reaching our goals around school readiness. And then this slide looks at what it would look like if the cost of the new regulation was absorbed by the subsidy program, which is also a hard decision to make when subsidies are helping low-income working families purchase and afford childcare. I do need to point out that this does not include the state's general fund investment. This is only looking at how we might slice the federal pie that comes to us. So those are choices that we're going to have to make and talk about more. And I just wanted to kind of show you what some options look like. Taking it out of quality and professional development, taking it out of subsidy. So at the same time, as we're called upon federally to do more monitoring for childcare to make sure that kids are in healthy and safe environments, we're also called upon to work to improve the quality of childcare. To Representative Taylor's point around making sure that these are environments where education and child development is happening on purpose, which we know is really important for school readiness and for our goals later around literacy. And you saw earlier in the presentation the number of children who are in childcare. And so that that represents a crucial opportunity for us to work with these providers to promote positive child development and to ensure that children have the skills and competencies that they need to be successful when they reach kindergarten. So in Oregon, we're building a system that rates and then also focuses on improving the quality of care, and that's what we call the quality rating improvement system. And it does a couple of core things. It creates a common set of standards of excellence that can be met by a diverse range of child care programs. It elevates the importance of the child care industry and the early learning sector. It kind of gets it on the grid. And it also puts tools, financial incentives, and expert advice in the hands of programs that are seeking to improve the quality of their work. And this is all done with ultimately the goal of helping kids be more ready for school. So basically, we have taken what research tells us promotes early learning and translated that into a common set of standards. And the standards, while they are common, are also pretty flexible, which allows for a diverse range of kinds of programs to participate in the QRIS, which is voluntary. The standards include things like, how do you engage families? How do you set up an early learning environment that's really rich in literacy opportunities? How do you set up a program to support positive adult-child interactions? How do you select a curriculum that aligns with Oregon's early learning framework? And then there are also supports built into the QRIS to help childcare providers really focus on how to build and sustain their business. So we know that childcare providers all want to give children the best, the children in their care the best possible early learning experiences. And so that's what this quality improvement effort is really about. It's about supporting providers to offer the kinds of experiences that they know that we know they want to offer. And so that's part of why the system has tiers. It's to provide stepping stones for providers to kind of meet them where they're at and help them move to the next level. So once you've gotten to a level three, which is a really great level, at a level three you have a curriculum, you have a really clearly articulated mission statement, a clear way that you're working with families. A three-star is a good rating. But then we're able to say, if you want to go to the next level, here are some steps that you might want to take, and here's some supports to help you get there. And while licensing is the foundation of the QRIS, we've found over the last year that we've been able to make it pretty inclusive. So Head Start is participating, child care centers are participating, and a lot of home-based child care providers are participating in this system. We are 1 year in to the field test of the quality rating improvement system. There are 230 programs around the state that have completed the process and received a star rating. And we anticipate these numbers more than doubling over the next 2 years, with a goal of hitting 500 star-rated programs benefiting close to 20,000 children. And that's a pretty big change in the course of a short number of years to help us on with our goals around school readiness. And so the development of the QRIS has been made possible by Oregon's $30 million Race to the Top Early Learning Challenge grant. And that grant has paid mostly for infrastructure of the QRIS. It paid for the development of the standards, the creation of the portfolio system that the programs use to track and demonstrate that they're making the standards, and the database that's allowing us to track that work. And the Early Learning Challenge grant comes to an end in December 2016, so the last half of this biennium, that grant goes away. And so we're in the process right now of developing what our transition plan looks like so that we can sustain the coaching and other supports that really make the QRIS work. And so I'll talk a little bit about what our thinking looks like in terms of sustainability. But the governor's requested budget does include a $5 million budget request to help with some sustainability around this program, to make sure that providers that serve low-income communities and communities of color are fully represented in the QRIS. And we've been using some of our Race to the Top funding to help us accomplish that goal through focused childcare networks, and that $5 million investment would help us continue that work. So like I said, the $30 million in this Race to the Top grant ends in December 2016. So I do want to address the question that's probably in everybody's mind, which is, what happens when the grant goes away? And am I going to be bringing you a $30 million bill and asking you to backfill that? And the answer to that question is no. The first part of my answer to sustainability is that this grant was really about systems building and not about direct services. So the Race to the Top grant allowed us to build infrastructure like the QRIS framework, like our professional development system. It's helped us do some work getting the early learning hubs up and running. And those pieces have been built, and they're here to stay when Race to the Top ends. And then we're also exploring how to leverage existing resources and existing staffing in new ways to sustain our Race to the Top investment. Race to the Top has taught us how to do some new things, and that doesn't mean that we need a whole bunch of new staff necessarily. It means that maybe some of the activities that we do currently need to change in order to support our work around quality. So in addition to the funding, the development of the QRIS, the grant supported coaching and technical assistance to programs that's helped them figure out how to implement new practices and strengthen early learning experiences. And we know that that coaching component is a really important part of what is driving the change and the improvement of quality in childcare. And so in star-rated facilities, the roles of some of our licensing staff might have to shift to support both regulatory work and quality improvement work. And then additionally, the Child Care Development Fund, which currently requires us to spend 4% of the federal allocation on quality, is now going to require us to spend 9% of the federal investment on quality with the new regulations. So that's another way that we can leverage current dollars that come to Oregon already to help sustain the Race to the Top work. Our statewide network of child care resource and referral agencies are also CCDF funded, and they're also poised to step in using that existing Child Care Development Fund support to support the ongoing training and support of our quality providers. So there will be some additional resources that we need, and I'll talk about that in a minute, but the point here is that having this federal grant that's taught us how to do quality work in this framework has caused a fundamental shift in early learning in Oregon. It's moved us from a licensing organization, a regulatory agency that looks at quality sometimes, to an organization that licenses and supports quality early learning programs, period. We're also seeing some really incredible opportunities to build off of and sustain Race to the Top coming out of this legislative session. House Bill 2015, which would strengthen employment-related daycare, is one of them. And I think folks have some passing familiarity with this, but just to remind you, House Bill 2015 would connect child care subsidies to the quality rating improvement system through tiered reimbursement for families. So a parent who's receiving a child care subsidy voluntarily chooses a star-rated program, and then they would be eligible for an enhanced, reduced co-payment, and the program would receive an enhanced payment in recognition of their investment in quality. And that allows us to leverage our investment in child care subsidies and leverage our investment that we've made in program quality. And then second, there's House Bill 3380, which is the policy bill that would create the mixed delivery preschool system I talked about yesterday. The mixed delivery preschool system would not really be possible if we hadn't done the work that we did over the course of the last year to create the hub system and to create the quality rating improvement system. It wouldn't be possible, or at least I would have a hard time making a case to this body that we should invest state funds in childcare if we didn't have some way of understanding the quality of what was happening and knowing that preschool dollars in childcare were being invested in preschool settings that met a set of standards. And so that mixed delivery preschool system wouldn't be possible if we hadn't done the work to build the quality rating improvement system, and presents an opportunity to kind of weave all of these pieces together in a really interesting way. Okay, so that's all the work that we're doing to use existing resources to sustain Race to the Top. And now I'm going to talk a little bit about some of the additional resources that we think we'll need. So when the Early Learning Division was created, very few new positions were added to support the operations of the division. It was woven together out of other state agencies. We've talked about that before. And Race to the Top really allowed us to get off the ground as a division. And some of those positions, we believe we need to continue to sustain the operations of the Early Learning Division and fulfill the charge that we've been given by this body. So there are 7 out of 16 limited duration positions that were funded through Reach to the Top.
Representative Huffman? No question? Okay.
That we are asking to convert to permanent positions. We've identified these as critical to the ongoing work of the division, and for this biennium, it comes at a cost of about $400,000. You can see the positions that we're asking to be made permanent listed here on the slide. Okay, and I just have 2 more slides to go, so I'm going really fast for you guys today. So maybe we can take lots of questions at the end if you have them. But before we end, I wanted to touch on one last component of the Race to the Top grant that's important for this committee to have an understanding of. And that is the Early Learning Information System, which we call ELIS. This is a data project that's being funded by this grant. Ben Tate from the Department of Education, the department's chief information officer, is here to help me answer any technical questions that you might have. But I'm going to talk first about the policy side of what the Early Learning Information System is. But basically, what this system will let us do once it's fully completed is to fully integrate the quality data from the QRIS with our licensing and compliance data. And that is going to significantly reduce the amount of paperwork that needs to get filled out, which will increase efficiency. And it's going to improve the speed of access, not only for our staff looking up compliance and quality history, but also to parents for valuable information. Having this database on the back end will allow us to have a parent or customer-facing website that's a lot more user-friendly, that will let people find information about the settings that they're putting their children in with much more ease than is currently possible today. So through the Early Learning Information System, our goal is that parents will be able to make more informed decisions, will be able to more efficiently process background checks, ensuring the health and safety of children, and will be able to strengthen our quality childcare initiatives, helping more children arrive at school ready. So we are following the DAS process for technology projects. And so that means right now we're in the process of finishing a business case for this system. And we will have that completed in May, which is this month, basically. And then our goal is to get the business case approved and get a request for proposals completed this summer and a vendor to build the system selected by early fall, and then have the system completed by December 31st, 2016. So I'm sure there's questions about this one. That's why I've got Ben with me to help answer them.
Questions? Senator Roblin.
Thank you. I guess it's a combination of this part and the new requirements that are going to go into effect. Mm-hmm. So we've got unregulated groups that are going to now be semi-regulated. Mm-hmm. And that's the issue. You know who they are because they receive ERDC money. So they are identified. Is there a process? When you're licensing somebody, you can, at the licensing time, you can make sure that all the new employees have gotten background checks and do all that kind of stuff. These are still not going to be licensed. So is there going to be an ongoing requirement that people who come new to the organization get background checks, and whether or not there is an ongoing check, whether it's the cheaper one or not, over the years, when a teacher gets a license, they go through a similar kind of background check. And is there going to be a place where in the system you identify each of the provider, not just the organization provider-wise, but each of the employees in that, and do they have to update it? I guess that's the
yes. Co-chairs Comp and Monroe, Senator Roblin, that's a great question. So yes, there'll be an annual monitoring process for these providers, license exempt or licensed. For license exempt providers, I don't imagine that they would have staff, because to stay license exempt, you can only care for 3 or fewer children. But they will be subject to a background check and an annual monitoring visit. And then they get enrolled in what we call the central background registry. And then the central background registry connects to their compliance history in our system. And that will happen for license-exempt providers receiving subsidy now in the same way that it happens for licensed providers. And that will all be captured in this system. This system is still being built. And what this one does is integrate all of that background check information and compliance history with the what we know about program quality and provider credentials. So that integrated system's being built, but we have separate data systems right now that let us know that information, so we have access to it.
And
go ahead.
So this new system that's being developed, is the backbone of that already in existence, or are we developing a whole new system? We have not had a lot of success at different times with other state programs in developing programs. So I just want to make, is this a totally new, or is there already a backbone that this is existing that we're just going to add stuff to?
Co-chairs Compton, Monroe, Senator Roebland, I know just enough about the technical side to get myself in trouble, so I think I'll have Ben answer that question.
Senators Compton, Monroe, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Ben Tate. I'm the Chief Information Officer for Department of Education. In answer to your question, the intent here is that we are going to buy an existing program, but what we are doing is basically integrating the needs of, as Megan mentioned, programs and databases that already exist. So I think the right answer is we're combining things in a new way, but the backbone of those systems are already in play.
Okay. Go ahead.
So now we'll go back to the policy part. You have these unregulated. You're going to do these background checks. What happens in the situation where a background check comes back and says, sorry, they are passing the background check? Have you figured out what's happening?
Yes. Co-chairs Compton, Monroe, Senator Roebland, we have a process inside the Office of Child Care already for what we do in that instance. One of the things that was really interesting for me to learn stepping into this role is that currently in the state there aren't any crimes that automatically boot you out, right. Although I believe DAS is working on updated statewide consistent background check policy. But when someone's background check comes back with a red flag, or something questionable, we staff it and do a suitability review. There are some things that would come back in a background check where the person would just automatically never move forward. Sex abuse, founded child welfare cases, things of that nature. And then there's things that come back that are questionable but that we need to do some thinking about, and often we'll reach out to like a person's mental health provider and ask for their professional opinion on whether the person is suitable to care for children. And then we do have to make judgment calls on that. And there's a pretty specific process that we follow for doing that work.
Go ahead.
So when you find that out, these are generally people who have a relationship with the person who's getting the child care. So they may not have any knowledge of that. So then there's also this confidentiality issue with respect to background checks. So we have policies in place that deal with how we release information?
Co-chairs Compton, Monroe, and Senator Roebland, for licensed care we do, because you're denied enrollment in the central background registry, and that precludes you from being able to provide care. I think that you're getting into one of the questions that's really tricky in implementation of the new federal rules around unregulated care that we haven't fully figured out yet. But it just speaks to the complexity of what it means to regulate unregulated care, which has been really interesting for us to contemplate. And we're not the only state that's struggling with some of those kinds of questions.
So, well,
go ahead.
So it is. Possible, because there's the unregulated, which we talked about, but there's also those that we don't even know anything about because they aren't getting any ERDC. So at the end of the day, the family could decide we aren't going to get ERD subsidy, and they could still have the same person offering child care, but they pay for it entirely and no ERDC, right?
Co-chairs Compton, Monroe, Senator Roebland, I think I understand the question that you're asking, but I'm not sure that's actually correct. But I would love to talk with my child care staff and see how they would answer that question, because that's a really interesting and kind of complicated question. But so I'd love to have the chance to talk it over with them and get back to you on that one. Yeah.
my final one, just to say that just listening to your conversation has given me, I don't envy you the next year and a half.
I like complex work,
okay, so that's good. It will be fun for me.
But it will be, these are really big changes. And again, the concept of what it means to regulate an unregulated marketplace, it's just a really interesting spot that we find ourselves in.
Oh, I'll do it.
Go ahead.
Separately, completely. Is the system at capacity? Do we have capacity within the system for new kids and for others, or are we, you know, places to send them? Are there slots for people in the regulated or unregulated issue?
Co-chairs Compton Monroe, Senator Roblin, the system's not at capacity, but I think a lot of what constrains parents' childcare choices is cost of care, and so I think that there are childcare providers in the state who have capacity to take on more children. What makes the marketplace so complicated is parents' ability to find a childcare provider in their area that matches with their personal values, that they can afford, that's open during the hours that they work. So it's not always a question of just capacity and are there providers available to take children. It's also, how do you match all of those needs with the right setting? And the cost of care in this state is one that really constrains parents' choices.
Okay. Representative Huffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And, you know, I'm concerned that government is playing a big role in the challenges with, we want kids safe. We want them in a safe environment, absolutely. But the more and more layers of requirements we add on, looking at increasing minimum wage, that's going to attack the very parents that need the service in a cost-effective manner. And so government stepping into stuff I see in the background of what's going on at the state level in this session, thinking about making decisions without economic information to understand the ramifications, the impact that it's going to have broad-based on some of the providers we're talking about today are a prime example, and the families that they serve. How's that going to impact stuff being talked about in this building right now that scares the heck out of me?
Madam Co-Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. First of all, Megan, you've given us a comprehensive, pretty full view of the challenges that we're facing. But as somebody, I used to do daycare many years ago, and what Senator Roblin was talking about, you know, matching up your schedules, and of course, when you're 25, you can get up at 5:30, 6 o'clock and take on somebody's infant. But I know for my own daughters, they have chosen providers that are licensed, and because again, if you have to drop your child off at 6 o'clock in the morning, I mean, there are so many challenges facing our young people today as they are in the workforce, and yet their top goal is to make sure their child is safe. And yes, I'm glad you like challenges, because this is big, and it really is. And it, to me, it's a little scary.
Senator Roblin.
Has there been a growth? I know in some places where my kids have gone and tried to find places that there is a growing number of employer-based licensed childcare. Is that happening in Oregon? You know, are there companies out there that are putting in licensed childcare facilities in their organizations for their employees?
Co-chairs Comp and Monroe, Senator Roblin, I know that there are, and we could pull some data for you if you're interested in what the number of what those numbers look like. I'd be happy to do that.
Okay.
That's all we have for you today.
Mr. Wilson.
I got here just in time.
That's it?
Megan, you're done, right?
I am.
You just got here.
I just want to tie a couple things together here because you'll hear some other issues that are somewhat related to some of this backfill need in the next couple weeks. On that slide, 2 points. There's an aggressive schedule for the information systems here. You're talking about roughly 18 months to complete a major product. Now, the good thing is that they're looking at using existing, purchasing something, but it still has to feed in. So, and you have other projects that have similar or greater challenges, including the statewide longitudinal data system, which you'll hear about probably in a couple of weeks in a little more detail when we bring back OEIB. And there are other systems needs in HEC that are significant you'll hear about. The second issue is you're being asked to backfill for staff and other sort of core services here because of the loss of the Race to the Top funds as they span out. You have a similar issue with what we call ALDER funding that you'll hear about next week and the need to backfill some of the staff in Mr. Tate's office, I believe. And another similar case when you hear HEC, where they'll have information system needs as they come together as a new agency, as well as feeding into some of the statewide longitudinal database needs. So let's keep that in mind. And these are all, unfortunately, not part of the current service level budget, and therefore not part of the co-chair's framework. So either going to be having to carve out or find sources for that. While none of them are gigantic amounts of money, they do add up over time.
Okay. And Mr. Wilson, we will not be meeting on Monday, but can you tell us what we'll be doing Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday?
Tuesday, Mr. Chair, you have at least two more licensing boards to work session, and that will be it for the health-related licensing boards. And that just leaves TSPC, ODE, which includes all this, HEC, and OEIB. Lots of money, not too many agencies left after that, but a lot of discussion that still has to take place. And then on Wednesday, there'll be a hearing by ODE, Mr. Saxton and his staff on assessments and assessment staffing. And what's sort of the future for that and budget needs. And then on Thursday will be sort of an agglomeration of policy package discussions and ODE's budget, ranging from staffing needs to Native American position for reach. So it's sort of a posh of things just to make sure you understand before we move to work session on some of the needs of that agency.
Okay. Questions? Madam Co-Chair, anything?
No. Yes, Thursday, and I think it's supposed to be nice, so.
Yes. Representative Huffman?
Well, and I was going to say, let's not let our worries bog us down too much today.
Oh,
about
okay.
Money and how we're going to make all this fit.
We get the day off?
Because it's Sunday outside.
Monday you do. Monday you
get off. Monday we can go to the beach.
Until we get to May 14th, I mean, then we can really start stewing or right. Worrying or whatever. Representative Huffman?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I wanted to thank Megan for the salary information. I was gone at the first part of the hearing when she probably mentioned it and wanted to let her know I do see it and thank it.
Okay.
So now you're going to change careers.
Anything else?
Absolutely.
It's better.
You can make more money.
I can hear a little bit out of this ear. Still can't hear out of this ear.
That's true. Actually,
I'm getting there. Doc Bates.
Yeah. During the hearing. Pardon? Adjourn the hearing.
Close the
always
hearing.
Always nice to have a doctor in the house. Doctor in the house. It's nice to have